I'm glad you brought that up. This is something that should be said then. What I was presenting tonight, I wasn't presenting as a once-and-for-all experience. I think this is the way of the Christian life. This is the sanctification pattern, if we can call it pattern. I don't like that word, pattern. But this is the description of sanctification that comes out of the Scriptures and out of our own heritage of the Reformation, of dying and rising. This is the very essence of Luther's understanding of baptism in its existential present tense situation. I relive, I renew my baptism as I die daily. And dying daily is never a pleasant thing. When you die pleasantly, you're not dying. Crucifixion is not pleasant. That God may by His miraculous power resurrect me. And this is how I grow. How can I grow except I am confronted more and more with the areas in where I need to grow? In other words, my sinfulness. The neophyte, if we can speak of a neophyte without trying to label who he is, in the Christian life is probably like the traditional view of the iceberg. 9/10 of himself regarding his sinfulness is below the surface. As he grows, more of this comes into his view. The natural reaction of seeing more of what I'm like is depressing. It throws me anew on the Christ and his all-sufficiency. God be merciful to me, a sinner, isn't something a person says when he enters God's kingdom. It's something he probably says the day he leaves this life and enters heaven. It's the end of the road as well as the beginning. It's something we don't graduate from. In other words, our holiness that is we're aware of may be a very dangerous situation. It's like claiming your humility. Now, if humility and sanctification are somewhat akin, then certainly in these crucifixion experiences, we're pretty close, even though we are least aware of it. And perhaps this is what we can point out here, that in our growing, probably even our own goodness is concealed from us in order that we might retain it. Remember the judgment when those are told to come in? And they say, why? He said, well, you fed me and stuff. When did we do all these things? Right hand not knowing what the left hand's doing. Well, for one thing, I think that, for example, let's take the area of family life. Now, most people in the congregation are involved some way or other with family life. And family life is of such a disturbing nature that the church has with some good concern at times thought that you could only find a holy life by departing from it. Now, if, you see, we have a different point of view, and if disturbance and crucifixion has a central place in our growth pattern, then the very ups and downs of family living that Christian people experience, I think, can be brought into the total framework of the Christian life in this manner, rather than being thought as something apart from it. In other words, the discouragements and the failures and the defeats that fathers and mothers experience can be a part of this dying to one's self-sufficiency to commit to God all the power that is available to do something. And so the very ups and downs of my life, in my work, in my life with my neighbor, my family, all I think would integrate religious life in much if we could tie this in with God's Spirit's persistent crucifixion of the old Adam that he might resurrect the new man. I think this has the advantage of making all life integrated in the Christian perspective. And putting away this false idea of a separation between the religious and the secular.
Chaplains and professors and perhaps a few others the great bulk of the clergy of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has duties that are quite similar, and I suppose perform tasks that in the main run in certain definite channels. But there always are those who do something that is a little bit different. And so a few years ago, one of our colleagues, one of our clergymen, in gratitude for the elementary education that he had received and for the guidance of the pastor under whom he had received it, set up a Lutheran Education Fund, the income of which helped to supply speakers on educational topics to this seminary and to some of our sister schools. As a result of this action, which is a little different and which is deeply appreciated, we have on our campus today Professor William Hume of the Lutheran Seminary of the American Lutheran Church in Dubuque, Iowa. Dr. Hume is a well-known teacher, a lecturer, and author. He has been on our campus before. Some of us have heard him. We have read his books on pastoral counseling, and we're happy to have him with us today as the E.H. Bergerman lecturer. These lectures were, as I mentioned, were named in honor of the pastor who supplied the elementary guidance to the clergyman who set up the lectures. The fact that a man has entered outer space and has returned again isn't going to heal or to lessen the spiritual illness on this globe. In fact, it may add some new aspects and some new entities to it. We're happy then that we have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Hume his presentation of the nature of spiritual illness. Dr. Hume.
Indeed, a pleasure and a privilege for me to be with you, be in your midst, and I bring you the greetings of the faculty and student body at the Wartburg Seminary. As Dr. Fierbringer said, this isn't the first time I've been on your campus, but there is one time that I was on your campus that stands out above all others, and that was when I was a senior at Capital University in 1944, and the senior class of Concordia Seminary invited the senior class of Catholic University and Wartburg Seminary to your campus. And I can honestly say, and as I look back on my senior year, this was the highlight. We had a tremendous time here. We thoroughly enjoyed it. We thoroughly enjoyed your hospitality and fellowship. And I don't know if those meetings were ever held after that or not. I lost contact, but it certainly was a wonderful thing. And I've always had a warm spot in my heart for the seminary since that time. As I recall, we were all quartered with some professors. And in those days, while you had many fine professors, as you do now, all of them fine, there was one, of course, that most everybody knew about because of his radio broadcast, and that was Dr. Meyer. And I can remember the thrill I had when, I forget who the faculty man was, he was telling us where we had to go, and I and another fellow were quartered with Dr. Meyer. And I sort of felt the envy of the rest of the group at that particular moment. We're going to discuss during this hour the nature of spiritual illness. I'm not going into any healing process, as it were. I'm reserving that for this evening. Our purpose this morning hour is more or less to describe the illness. to have a theological perspective of the person, as this person lives in our kind of world. All of us are fixed to a degree, and so when I talk about the nature of spiritual illness, I'm pretty sure that you'll see some of yourself in some of the things I say. And in a sense, then, we are holding up the mirror. But since we have such a glorious answer to the spiritual illness, this need not be a cause for despair, as it must be, if we can have the good news. Ours has been characterized as an age of anxiety. And we can say that we are basically sick with anxiety. And so we shall begin our understanding of the spiritual illness by looking into the nature of our anxiety. We will begin with what we would call given anxiety, existential anxiety. Anxiety is a goal with being a human being. It cannot be avoided because they are part and parcel of human nature in this kind of world. The first I would call finitude anxiety. We are aware that we are limited or finite only because we can compare it with an unlimited or an infinite. And we seem to have a pretty strong sense of the infinite within us because every evidence of the finite about us meets with strong and immediate protest. One of the big emphasis of our finitude would be our failures and how we suffer over our failures. Another would be our sicknesses, those physical ills that lay us flat on our back, our mental ills that more or less put us on the shelf for the time being. How we fight for health. And of course, the biggest sign of our finitude of all is the fact that we die. And there has been a quest among all peoples of all cultures to find the secret for immortality, because the human being protests very deeply that he must come to an end. Charles Clayton Morrison has said that the early church grew from 11 men to tens of thousands in the first generation after Christ because it conquered death, the final enemy of every living soul. Now this finitude anxiety goes as being a creature. It means that we are dependent. And the prayer, "Lord, save me," is a pretty elementary form of prayer. And the sentiment of dependency is a pretty dominant religious sentiment. It can be expressed in the prayer of the Breton fisherman. "O God, thy sea is so large and my boat is so small." And this is the way we experience our finitude and the anxiety that produces being so small in such a vast world. We are therefore overcome with an awareness of our weakness. And the very fact that we are weak and there are so many challenges before us creates anxiety. And we have faith at times to meet these challenges in spite of our weaknesses. But this very faith is continually being challenged by doubt. Doubt that I don't, doubt that I cannot, doubt over whether or not I am too late. That I will be swallowed up, and that after all, life is really one big cosmic fart. And the futility of it all is symbolized in the fact that all life shall end in death. The second anxiety that goes with life is estrangement anxiety. Here we are confronted with the aloneness of our individuality. And this can be a very terrifying thing to adolescents, as for the first time they're coming into a full realization of what it means to be a person, cut off in the depth from all other persons. A child feels pretty much indistinguishable from his family. But in adolescence, he begins to grow into that awareness that he is a distinct individual. And he begins, of course, at that time also to comprehend the extent of his similitude and the very personal and unique experience that is before him as it is before all. The personal experience par excellence, death. I recall one teenager describing this in terms of a recurrent dream, that she was like a whirling ball. In fact, she identified herself with a whirling ball in her dream, whirling and whirling and whirling out into space, going nowhere, lost in the tremendous magnitude of nothingness. Now, this dream, because it was repeated over and over again in their life, was obviously a sign of the terror in which this aloneness of individuality was bearing down upon her in her growingness into adulthood. And in the midst of this aloneness, this estrangement of being an individual, we seek relationships to dull the anxiety of being alone. We seek human relationships. We seek to be close to people. But we also have here the religious quest. The quest also to relate to the Creator, the Infinite One. Now, this very aloneness and estrangement is aggravated in our day and in our culture by the increased urbanization of our culture and industrialization of our living. So we can have extreme cases of loneliness in the midst of our most heavily populated areas. And for one who lives in a rather small town, and who has lived in a rather small town for the last 12 years, first Waverly and then Dubuque from 5,000 to 50, I am usually impressed when I visit a town like Chicago by the fact that I don't walk down the street from Loop very far before I pass somebody talking to himself, oblivious to the fact that there are many, many people all about him. If he would do that in my town, he would soon be accosted by a policeman and would be sent to our mental hospital. But here, where there are so many people, you can have these extreme cases of individuality and loneliness that one can even be communing with himself out loud. Others may not even notice it. People can be seen together in apartment houses and not only not know anybody else, but not even care to know anybody else in the same apartment building. Here we have then a loss of a sense of identity, a loss of a sense of communion, of belonging. And this degeneration of fellowship and communion extends also even into our rural areas today. That is, we are experiencing decline in the solidarity of the rural area. Where heretofore the rural area had its own community, today, with increased population into the city, with transportation so easy to the nearest city, and with the downgrade of the number of people needed in farm through the farm machinery, the farm community is being broken up one by one. Are these communities ceasing to be really communities? And we're finding the same sort of anxiety and illness in the rural areas as we find the heavy population centers. Now, there are some superficial attempts that we all make to try and heal this estrangement anxiety. A great deal of socialization may go on, and we see that in our day. But it can be very superficial also. We have a lot of grouping instead of relating. In the midst of all the grouping, however, at the basis of the individual soul, there is an extreme sense of emotional isolation, of real, genuine communion. And this is seen as extreme in the case of the alcoholic, who is growing dangerously in our community to where alcoholism is almost the stage of a national emergency. The alcoholic is one who is extremely cut off within, and by the use of alcohol, lives in his own fantastic world,
in which he is king,
and wherein no one else exists.
The third anxiety that goes with the givenness of life is moral anxiety. Moral anxiety comes out of the dialectical nature of man. That is to say, climax is here. We mentioned previously in regard to the anxiety of finitude that the fact that we are mortal disturbs us, for we long for immortality. We do not want to end. And so we have then the fact that we are overcome by awareness of our mortality and yet protest it, a dialectic. Also, we have talked about the weakness that we experience because of this finitude. At the same time, in the midst of our weakness, we admire the strong. We'd like to be strong, and we work toward being strong. We talked also about faith, carrying us through some of the challenges that face us in our weakness. We also talked about doubt as being the contradiction to this faith, continually gnawing away at the faith and challenging the faith to rise above it. There's also a dialectic in the very evilness that we experience within us. Even the evilness that we experience has its protest, the conscience protest, as it were, toward the good. And we can have an admiration for the good in the midst of the awareness of our own evil. And this is not a conflict, this conflict between good and evil. It exists only in the Christian. It exists also in the natural man. Although in the natural man we have a distortion in terms of what is evil and what is good. Nevertheless, the tension between the two exists. This moral anxiety is described, I think, most fully in the 7th chapter of Romans. I will read from the 15th to the 24th verses. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. Now if I do what I do not want, I agree the law is good. So then it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells within me. There is the dialectic right here. For I know that nothing good dwells within me, that is, in my flesh. I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I that do it, but sin which dwells within me. So if I am to be a law, and when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand. For I delight in the law of God in my inmost self. But I see in my members another law, at war with the law of my mind, and making me captive to the law of sin which dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? There is your tension of moral anxiety. And I think the real anxiety behind this weakness is the fact that there is the will to evil. In other words, the evil that I would not is also the evil that I would. And the good that I would is also the good that I would not. And this results in guilt. We fear the consequences of our duplicity, our perverseness. We feel the judgment, the condemnation, on the hypocrisy. We can look at guilt from three areas. The first would be the contrast between genuine guilt and neurotic guilt. A genuine guilt comes out of the realization of this very nature of dialectical anxiety in the moral area, where I see not only my impotency due to my limitations, but my perverseness due to my misuse of freedom. Neurotic guilt is an attempt to cover over here. In neurotic guilt, one can't stand to face this real basic guilt of his own insincerity. And so neurotic guilt is a defense type of guilt,
where I become very much disturbed over a smaller thing. In order to concentrate this guilt that I feel on the smaller thing. And so I avoid the condemnation that I feel in the depths of my soul over the larger issue. Another couple would be the contrast between conscious guilt and unconscious guilt. Conscious guilt is obviously that which I am aware of. But a great deal, perhaps, of the guilt that I experience, I have not been able to face and have pushed it into the area of my unawareness. We would call this unconscious guilt. And the third would be the contrast between psychological guilt and religious guilt. In psychological guilt, we are disturbed because our public relations have been impaired by our actions. We are primarily concerned about what people will think. We are primarily concerned about the mental image of us that others have in their minds. And any indication on our part that we have disturbed this mental image in an adverse way creates the pangs of guilt. But this I would call a psychological type of guilt. I want to get on with people and I'm disturbed when it seems I'm not. Religious guilt is of a stronger stature. Religious guilt is concerned about my standing before my Maker and my Maker's evaluation of me. Now, in pastoral care, our challenge is to help this guilt to mature, that is to help neurotic guilt to develop into an awareness of the genuine guilt behind, so that one doesn't need the defense of a neurotic guilt. To help the unconscious guilt to come up into the conscious where it can be faced by the increase of our courage, and to help psychological guilt to grow to the dimension of religious guilt, because it's only when guilt has reached its religious height that the gospel has any connection for it. And I'm afraid that most of us, our experiences of guilt as a people, are in these immature, undeveloped areas. One of the things that helps us to keep guilt immature is the role of self-deception. In an attempt to still the anxiety that is produced by this moral dialectic, we have been endowed with the ability to deceive ourselves to some extent. That is, we can will not to see what we do not want to see, will not to know what we do not want to know. And if it's in the Platonic concept of Socrates, he placed the essence of sin in ignorance, that Christian religion could only go along with that in the extent that the essence of sin might be in the will to be ignorant, the determination to be ignorant, in order to escape the judgment that I know down deep I deserve. We can see this in the story of the Garden of Eden, this area of self-deception. Adam and his wife knew what they had done. They had rebelled against their God by partaking of the fruit they were told they should not partake of, for in that if they could sit of it, they would have the knowledge of good and evil. It would be as God had attempted. Now the amazing thing is that after they had partaken of it and began to experience what it meant that the Creator said that they had eaten of it shall surely die, began to experience the estrangement that guilt creates, the shame of having rebelled, that this inner misery that they were experiencing, they then identified with the fact that they were naked and attempted to cover their nakedness, in a sense, cover their guilt. And when God confronts the man in his hiding due to his anxiety over his moral duplicity, he said, why are you hiding? And the man said, because I was naked. Now, there's a beautiful illustration of how we can deceive ourselves. And I really think that Adam probably half believed it by this time, because his followers certainly can do it in about that speed. And God refuses to be fooled.
and he penetrates right through the rationalization and says, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten of the fruit? And what is the reaction of the man? The woman that you gave me, God. In other words, when we are trapped, when the self-deception is pulled away and we're standing naked and exposed, we get mad. We lash out and blame others. Don't blame me, God. You gave me this woman. She didn't accept it. But when the woman was confronted, why, you know where she placed the blame. Anything, you see, but to stand before God and say, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Naked. Well, the result of this is that if you're going to deceive yourself in order to protect yourself, you automatically have to reduce your sense of consciousness. You might say our personhood develops as our sense of consciousness develops. And therefore, to deceive ourselves, we have to shorten the area of consciousness as we increase the area of the unconsciousness. Well, now, the more you shorten the area of consciousness to protect yourself from those things in your life that you do not wish to see, then the more you shorten your life. The more you become a little island, something perhaps even less than the person that you could be. Something perhaps even less than the person that you could be. But fortunately, self-deception is never complete. Even if we have been endowed with this ability, we have not been endowed with it completely. We can never fully deceive ourselves. Regardless of how far Adam had gone, the minute God penetrated, Adam knew he was caught. Around the edges of the little island that we shrink ourselves into, the truth threatens always to come up. And so in defense, we have to keep searching. And this awareness that the truth is always ready to come up on the edge of our consciousness, that we are searching in self-defense, keeps us on edge, keeps us jittery. But this reduced consciousness leads to a stunted life, and this is tragic. Now let's look into another area of spiritual illness, the problems that we face in living. Now, first of all, there are the frustrations in self-expression. We have a need as human beings to express our will, to express our individuality, our personhood. And when this is thwarted, there is revenge. That is, every human being seems to believe within all his heart and mind that he should be free. And the way to prove it is try and take his freedom away from him. I can just imagine what you students would do if the administration here took away some of your liberty that you have now. I know what our students would do. I know what they do. There were protest meetings. This is our animal right, as it were. Now, if this freedom is taken away from us, we will rebel. We will rebel overtly if we can, that is, if we can get away with it. But if it's a threatening thing to rebel overtly, then we will rebel covertly. We'll force conformity in some way or other. Either passively, if we can't do it actively, or subconsciously, if we can't do it consciously. Recall the story in the Bible where Jesus told a father had two sons. And he said to the one, go, work in the vineyard. He said, I go, sir. But somehow he never got around to doing it. And this is the way the rebellion that cannot come out can work itself out in some way or other that we sabotage, really giving our whole heart into what we really can't believe is our own free choice. We know that Christian college, it's very hard to have a college student really give his all when he thinks he's at college only because somebody forced him. And I imagine the same would be true of seminary. In some way, when we can't rebel openly, we rebel undercover. We sabotage. Now, this need to express ourselves is a natural thing. It shows of being a human being. But But it too, like everything else in this world, is distorted by the flesh, by the egocentric tendency, in which to express ourselves can become a means to power, a will to power, instead of simply a will to express oneself. And this can very easily merge into a lust for power. And power means power over somebody else. We can really see how this is operating in our society. The second under the frustrations in self-expression would be the need for the expression of our creative nature. We are created in God's image. This means, of course, many things. But for our point here, it means that as God is creator, so those created in his image are creative. And we have a need to achieve. A need to accomplish. And if this is blocked, we become ill in one way or another. We have a need to express whatever creative urge we have been endowed with. And out of this comes a need for one's own sense of self-worth, one's sense of purpose, one's sense of fulfillment of his purpose. Also, closely associated with this is the need for approval. I mean, for my own approval of myself and for the approval of others of me. Now here the conformist and the rebel may have to conflict, you see. Because in order to get people's approval for my achievements and my accomplishments, I pretty much have to conform. And I suppose this is the dominant element of our society. At least David Reisman thinks so in his book, The Lonely Crowd, that we are outer-directed. But at the same time, I resist, you see, in terms of my freedom, conforming where I would rather not. And so the conflict, you see, of going along with what I believe is necessary for my approval, and having my approval, or sabotaging this conformity, losing approval, but experiencing freedom. Now this need to express myself in terms of accomplishment and creatively in terms of achievement is a stimulus for competition. Because as you know, in our age, it isn't only what you do, but how well you do it compared to somebody else who's in the same area. For example, if your professor gives out the corrected test papers today, the test that you took last week, and you look at your grades, your immediate thought is, I wonder how this stacks up with the others. And so you'll begin to try and inquire, subtly or however you may have to do it, what'd you get? Your main interest isn't, I hope you did well. Your main interest is, I hope I didn't do too badly, and I'll find out if I find out how well you did. And when he did well, of course, he said, oh, good. Then we just say, oh, good night. Well, accomplishment's a very comparative thing. And this, too, gets involved with the flesh. And the main idea, then, seems to be not really to accomplish, but to do something at the top. You can see this already in terms of children and parents. The child comes home with his report card. He's got an A. Or he's got an A on his paper. And the parent says, well, fine, son. Were there any other A's? If there were, it isn't quite so good, you see. And if there were, then you want to say, well, who got the highest A? Now, if somebody has a higher A, you know, somebody's got 99, you only have 97, the father says, well, you work hard, son. You can't get that 99 and stuff. In other words, get on top. This is all that really matters. Get on top. Now, this is a type of competition before which some people just give up. They know they can't get on top. They know unless they get on top, whatever they do doesn't mean anything, so why try at all? And at the same time, it's a competition before which some feel absolutely compelled to succeed. And either way, you see, you have an extreme compulsion. Either extreme compulsion is too much, so you can be trying, or extreme compulsion, I've got to give everything because if I'm not on top, I'm not worth it. access that to difficulties in personal relations. Out of the estrangement anxiety, we notice that we have a strong need for union with others, a strong need to belong. I'm sure you have that right in your own student group. You want to have a place in your student group, and you want to think that others think well of you, value you. This is natural. This is normal. And this helps very much to overcome the pain of estrangement. And you know how lonely you can feel when you're a new man in a community that is well known to each other. Therefore, we have a strong need for evidence that we are a part of the group, that we have a union with others. You might call the need for affection, in a broad sense of the term, a need for evidence that we are liked, that we're valued, that we're appreciated. And therefore, we are strongly moved in this need for personal relations, strongly moved to create a good mental picture of ourselves in another person's mind, whose opinion we value. Now, even the fellow who says, I don't care what people think, he's very careful to make sure that people get that impression of him. And it would strike me very much if he thought they got the impression he did care what people think. He definitely doesn't care. And people think that he doesn't care what people think. This is part of his stature. This he thinks is respectable. It gives him independence, and people like independent people. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we will recognize that a lot of our efforts are put into improving the mental image of ourselves and other people's minds. And there's always a fear that we'll fail here, that we won't succeed. And we're very sensitive then to any indication in this direction that we're not succeeding. A lack of response can be present. It would set up the destructive powers of fear. Anxiety again, and guilt. What kind of a person am I? Well, I don't seem to be able to make it. And where this bid for affection of appreciation is refused openly, there could be a definite sense of anger, resentment, hostility towards such a person. This is why we've always said that love and hate, and this any natural sense of the term, they really swing back and forth, depending on the response. You see, there's an extreme situation in your not too uncommon statements in the newspaper, where as a result of broken romance, in a fit of temporary insanity, you might say, the rejected lover slays his former lover and says, I loved her so much, I couldn't stand to see her be with anybody else. Well, he really did say, I hated her so much for not responding to my love that I couldn't stand to do anything else but to kill her. So this is a real source of anxiety, this resentment that I experience toward those who don't come across with the evidence that I am making a grave in terms of the mental picture of me they have in their mind. A source of anxiety because I'm not too sure, you see, if I ever carried out my anger, just what I might do. Once I would get started releasing my anger, I may not be sure whether I can control the situation from then on. And I also wouldn't want anybody else to know it. Because if people would see how resentful I am and how jealous I am and how small I can be in regard to these symptoms of whether I'm accepted or not, they certainly wouldn't want to. And we always have a feeling, I don't know why, that we're half exposed. No matter how many clothes we have on, figuratively speaking, there's always that fear that people can somehow see through us. And so the anxiety is perpetuated here. Now we have in terms of people, the predicament of being dependent upon them and upon their opinion, upon their overtures, the response, at the same time, hating it. Because in being dependent, we, of course, are trying to be one with them. This is the need in terms of the estrangement anxiety. However, in terms of depending upon and having to have it, you see, we become something less than three people, And we hate this because it is, in a sense, a type of restriction on our basic integrity as a person. And this leads to exploiting other people. And we feel guilty about that, too. The tendency of all of us is to like those whom we need and to try and ingratiate ourselves with those who can help us. And so we come to the conclusion at times that we are using people rather than relating to them. Maybe we have to be very careful of this in the ministry, because we have two people, you know, in the community congregation that can do us much good so far as the plans we have for the building of the kingdom of God in this particular local congregation. So much easier to see them first when we look out upon the congregation. The third area in the problems of living would be disturbances in sexuality. Boy thought of sex as an undisciplined biological urge, and I think many Christians agree with it. It is, of course, an undisciplined biological urge, but from the point of view of the scriptures, it's much more than that. The divinely endowed gift to man by which he relates intimately to another in the most intimate of all unions, marriage. And it is rather significant, I think, that where there are problems in relations, where people feel cut off emotionally from others, their sexual endowment is agitated, as it were in compensation, if not in protest. So that in pastoral counseling, for instance, with people who are disturbed over their apparent sexual agitation, which is causing them no end of problems, you very often find a very lonely person, at least one who in the very depth of his being does not experience any real sharing with anybody else. Here you have the spiritual dimension of sexuality and the evidence of the oneness of body and mind and soul here in a fleshly, potent person. That is, even the apparently biological urge of sex is accentuated and is agitated when people feel cut off from others in terms of intimate relations. Because it's a compensation, you are, a protest, a desire to relate coming out in this physical way. The biological sensation alone would leave us empty. I believe this is well illustrated in auto-stimulation. Namely, that when the fantasy, that fantasizes a relationship in auto-stimulation, in the, you might say, followed up with the terrific reality of our aloneness following the auto-stimulation, a sense of being cheated, a sense of being deceived is quite overwhelming. And this is, I think, one of the intensities of the guilt in the church. Now, in spiritual illness, sex can serve the cause for immediacy of Kierkegaard, we call it, as a defense against a preoccupation with despair. In the same way that one can use food. And we notice that there are people, maybe even oftentimes, who when we feel down, depressed, cut off, rejected, will eat more, particularly more sweets. Others will drink more, particularly more alcohol. And promiscuity and sex is another way to dull the senses to despair and lose oneself in immediate satisfaction. By the way, a very socially acceptable one is simply go to sleep. The whole idea of all of these means is to bring immediate satisfaction. So it's superficial. Immediate comfort, or if you will, immediate anesthesia. But then also in the words of Kierkegaard, when we use things in this way to bring an immediate end through satisfaction to the obvious reality of despair, we never become a self. Our final point is the defenses against these disturbances we've been talking about. First of all, there is a defense against recognizing that one has a spiritual illness. A And we have a good example of this in our day, what we call the psychosomatic complication. I am positive that you as ministers are going to have this referred to you many times by physicians. More and more, physicians are referring people with psychosomatic illnesses to their ministry. Because the psychosomatic illness, you see, is becoming recognized so much more today than it was before by medical people. But up to 50%, some physicians are estimating, of the people in their offices have not only something bothering them physically, but something bothering them spiritually, something wrong with the inner self, which is coming out in this physical way. Now, it's easier to live with a sore back, you see, or a stomach ache, than it is to live with some of these inner problems of guilt and shame and fear. And so you can talk much better in our society about your headache than about your despair over your unhappiness. And so the tip against recognizing the problem in our day is quite strong in the direction of shifting it to a physical situation. But unfortunately, if the physical situation of pills aren't going to do much for, because we need the illness, you see. And we'll hold on to it. The second defense would be a projection on the others. If I can't stand to look at my own threatening evil, then I can look at it better if I see it in somebody else. Also, if I see it in somebody else, I have a good object upon which to release my anger at my own evil, you know, vicariously. This is why parents, when they see their child following a weakness of theirs, can get doubly angry. One for the child, one for themselves. A good shot. Also, we find that if we have irritation toward others and anger, maybe even hate at times that we can't stand to look at, it's quite handy to project these out to these people and say they don't like me. And therefore I'm justified in the way I feel about them. Project it out and then release all that you would normally release towards yourself on somebody else. And the third one is in overcompensation. That is, overdo the opposite. If I have a whole lot of anger toward people, then become a compulsive smiler. Some people even smile when they tell you bad news. It's just always out there as a defense. Or I can become a crusader for some reform, thus giving an evidence of my extreme sense of righteousness. A compensation is overdoing an outward manifestation to make sure nobody can see its opposite inside. The only trouble is when it comes to God, these things don't work and you know it. Because in the language of John, he knows what's in man. Secondly, defenses against solving the problem. Now, one may recognize the problem, and you'll have this in your ministry quite often. They'll recognize the problem, they'll even come to you for help, but they aren't going to be very happy about finding that. In other words, there are people who would rather complain than do much else. It's much easier to be remorseful than to change. The purpose, in other words, of the problem is that it is the lesser pain, and if one gives up the lesser pain, one is thrown towards the greater pain. The deeper despair. And therefore, people who defend themselves against solving the problem obviously need the problem. And it is a type of support or crutch for them. It may even be a way in which they avoid other obligations. You see, I'm disturbed. You can't ask me the same things you'd ask other people. Well, there are a lot of reasons why people may not want to give up their sickness. And you'll discover this when we realize that they obviously are resisting any change in their views. They're running from responsibility. Their problem is remaining immature. And the very thought of becoming mature and responsible is frightening. It is more demanding. Also, one's illness may be a point of contact. As long as I have this problem, people will pay attention to me, particularly the minister. Now, if I let him help me solve it, Will he be as attentive to me from here on in? Now, we don't think of it consciously, but this is what may be going on over at the end. Also, it may be a means of protest. That is one very sense of having an illness that he doesn't want to give up. Maybe his way of saying, look how I've been wrong. And if I allowed myself to become well, I wouldn't have any way in which to protest to the way people and maybe even God have treated me. We call that maybe that section in Kierkegaard's Sacred Fundament where he speaks about this type of thing in terms of printer's error. He says, when we're in this way, we're like a printer's error. The printer's made the error, but the error will not allow the printer to correct it. Because he said, I want to stand and testify to what a lucky printer you are. A process of pride. There's a resistance to change in people. There's a certain pride that one loses in giving in to a solution. And repentance, therefore, is probably the most difficult operation the Holy Spirit can affect within people because of man's radical change. And in pastoral care, in pastoral counseling, we have obvious evidence about us of the perverseness and devious character of human resistance. Human resistance to hope. So we can see that our illnesses can come about from a situation in our environment which makes us ill. For example, a terrific tragedy, disappointment, something that confronts us with the given anxieties of life in intense form. We also see that the sister can be inside the person and reach out and create an environmental situation, which is sickening, as it were. And these latter are most difficult for the pastor to minister to. That is, we come often to the present situation with past predispositions. And we color the present with what we are, and what we are has come out of our development. So we can say that for every present situation, there is a past which makes itself known here. The person himself has interacted and colored the situation. On the other hand, the past of a person's life is only important in terms of pastoral care when it's still living in the present in some different style. The present also is affected by the pull of the future. Its goals, its threats. For instance, those of you that are about to graduate, I'm sure the future has a terrific pull on you right now in the way you operate and act and feel and think. Your calls and thoughts, how you read, all this is involved. The future thus has a very decided influence on the present. So present fears anticipate future catastrophes, and present drives anticipate future fulfillment. Now this evening I want to go into this on a more personal basis, more might I say on a existential basis, and out of this reveal the Christian answer in terms of God's gospel to the spiritual illnesses of mankind. Thank you very much for your time today.
Your presentation was obviously biblical and orientated from Lutheran theology. Now you indicated in a few instances some of the opposite viewpoints. I wonder whether there's anything further that you can say to future ministers with regard to literature that would present a danger or a booby trap to someone who is anxious to read up in this area.
I think Christianity, like, I think I can analyze it with these seconds here.
Christianity, I think, is, well, I don't know of any other approach to human illnesses than the human person that leaves one with a self, and it's all over. Every other approach ends up by making man a product of something. Thus, he loses all responsibility for himself. The Marxist makes him a product of an unjust economic society. Pat Horney and her cultural analysis, which is a very fine approach, finally comes down to the fact that man is a victim of the perverseness in his culture. Freud has him the victim of a conflict between his ego and his superego and his id, which is just part of living. And if you go right down the line, I think it's only the Christian religion that can describe the human illness and describe the answer and still retain a place for this thing called the self. In other words, still retain a place for human freedom. And it seems to me that this is a tremendous testimony to the uniqueness of our church.
Thank you. I'd like to remind you then that this evening's lecture begins at 7 o'clock.